Okay, well, Christmas, as you know, is almost with us. So I hope we're all fired up with anticipation, looking forward to it. The lights are blazing on Oxford Street. The garden centres have dug up all the Christmas trees, mince pies, Christmas puddings, brandy butter. They're all flying off the shelves. And hopefully you're looking forward to 2 weeks off work to spend quality time with family, to put your feet up, to reflect in peace and tranquility about the real meaning of Christmas. God coming to reveal himself to his people, or the Word becoming flesh, as John's Gospel puts it. But if you've come to hear that side of Christmas today, then I'm afraid I've got bad news for you, because the carol service is next week, and this week, as you've already heard, we're still in Ecclesiastes. And I'm sure if the teacher had his opportunity, he'd give you a very different slant on things, because he'd remind you there's only 12 shopping days to go before Christmas. And where are you going to find time to do all the Christmas shopping anyway? When your desk's piled high with work and you're probably out every night this week and most of next, and no doubt you've got that dreaded office party coming up as well. So, yes, you may be spending Christmas with your family, but you've probably got to travel 200 miles or so on the motorway, nose to tail, before you get there. And then when you finally arrive, you'll have the same arguments that you've had for the last 20 years or so. So, yes, the birth of Jesus should really be what Christmas is all about, but in reality, it's the last thing on your mind right here and now. So I'm not going to ask you how Christmas really feels to you at the moment, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's more likely to be the teacher's version, because this is life under the sun. This is what life, subject to the frustrations of this world, is really like. But if you've been with us these last few weeks, that you'll know that the teacher's actually been concerned with far deeper things than just the everyday strains and stresses. Even the greatest pleasures in life, he puts a rather darker perspective on. And he declares it all meaningless. Nothing lasts forever under the sun. We're all born. We all die. So we may have left last week at the end of chapter 2 and started this week at the end of chapter 11. But actually, if you read the 8 or 9 chapters in the middle, it's actually pretty well a variation on the same theme. So as we reach the climax of the book today, it's as if we're just longing for that chink of light to start coming through, streaming through the darkness. Surely things must get better. But if you look at the main part of this week's reading, you can easily argue things are actually getting worse. Because from verse 9 of chapter 11 through to verse 8 of chapter 12, the teacher takes us through every stage of life and still renders it all utterly meaningless. So I want to skip quite quickly through this bit, partly because I don't want to depress you too much, but mainly because I want to leave just a little bit of time at the end to have a look at the final few verses to make sure we bring this whole book to a proper conclusion. So if we go to verse 9 of chapter 11 to start with, you'll see that the teacher starts by looking at youth. And for a minute, it does actually look like the curtain's coming back, and we are indeed starting to let in the light. So we've got verse 9, "You who are young, be happy while you're young, and let your heart give you joy in the days of your youth. Follow the ways of your heart, and whatever your eyes see." So, you know, it starts sound, it's quite promising, really, isn't it? And yeah, then you get straight away, "But know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment." So bang, yeah, back down to earth straight away. And then if you look at verse 10, "So then, banish anxiety from your heart and cast off the troubles of your body, for youth and vigor are meaningless." So what you see is that if you look at verse 9 again, in the light of verse 10, it actually looks as if the teacher's words in verse 9 are really not much more than a throwaway comment. So it's more as if he's looking at youth from an older person's perspective. So it's like he's saying in verse 10, "Look, old man or old woman, I know your body's starting to feel the strain and you wish you were young, but these youngsters, they'll be called to account for what they do with their youth. And don't worry, they'll soon be old and decrepit like you anyway." So there's not really a lightening of the mood here at all. And then having used those two verses as sort of starter for 10, he then proceeds to turn both barrels on the full force of old age as you move into chapter 12. Because what we've got there is an absolutely withering analysis of getting old, but it is couched in wonderfully poetic language. So I've looked at quite a few commentators on this, and they give slightly different versions of what the verses and the phrases mean. But I'll go through it just so you get a picture of what's actually there. So I'll go through it verse by verse. Verse 1, remember your Creator in the days of your youth before the days of trouble come. So days of trouble, they're literally days of evil. Okay, so this is bad news. And the years approach when you will say, I find no pleasure in them. So there's a general sort of lessening in joy as you get older. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars grow dark, possibly you lose your sight there, and the clouds return after the rain. So grayness, possibly grayness of life, possibly even one illness after another keeps on coming back, the clouds after rain, or possibly just confusion. Verse 3, when the keepers of the house tremble, the keepers, apparently your hands and your arms, so they start shaking. The strong men stoop, strong men are your legs, so they start going. And then the grinders cease, because they're few. That's when your teeth fall out, if you hadn't worked that one out. That's good fun. Those looking through the windows grow dim, maybe your eyes. But then you go on to the next verse, when the doors to the street are closed, so it may just be you spend more time indoors, and the sound of grinding fades. Might be your hearing going, but it may be just those two sentences together, just say you finish work, then most of your time indoors and work ceases. When people rise up at the sound of birds, old people tend to get up early, for not necessarily for any good reason, but all their songs grow faint. So possibly their ears going again, or possibly just ability to sing, sort of general sense of music goes. When people are afraid of heights and of dangers in the streets, so you might lose your balance, maybe being afraid of being mugged, or just generally the pace of life is just too fast all around you. When the almond tree blossoms, that's one of my favourites. That's when you go grey or white, so the almond tree comes out, so your hair turns colour. And the grasshopper drags itself along, so you stumble along. Desire no longer is stirred. There was one commentator there who said, actually, that's appetite for food, which has gone. Everybody else agrees it's appetite for sex has diminished. So there you go. It's brilliantly depressing stuff. You may argue what some of the details mean, but you can't possibly fail to get the big picture. Old age is indeed, in the teacher's eyes, trouble or evil. And finally, in verse 6, everything falls apart. Nothing works as it should. Verse 7, death comes. Dust returns to the ground it came from. And then verse 8 exclaims the final time, meaningless, meaningless. Everything is meaningless. So we're born, we suffer, we die. That's what life under the sun is like. So it's really chilling stuff. And as we read it, everything in us wants to explain it away. But the problem is, it's true. Factually, it's almost impossible to argue with anything that the teacher says. So you or I might want to look at it from a very different perspective, but we can't easily say he's wrong. So before we try and gloss over it and brush it under the carpet, I have to ask, have you ever been there? Have you ever seen things through the teacher's eyes and felt the truth of what he's saying? Because all of us tend to live life in the moment and gloss over the deeper issues. Because, you know, we don't really want to go there, do we? But sooner or later, the storms come, and hiding away from the realities of life can't last forever. For me, speaking personally, I did actually have an Ecclesiastes moment, and it came when I was 20. I'd finished my first year at university, and generally life was pretty good. I was enjoying myself, I had plenty of friends, I even had money in the bank as well as a student, because I'd saved up a little bit from my gap year. And I'd also started going out with a girl who subsequently became my wife, and we're actually now looking forward to our 30th wedding anniversary next year. So life was fine. There was no earthly reason why I should have a problem. But it was the summer holiday, and I happened to be staying just down the road in Notting Hill with friends of my parents, and they were building an extension on their house, and I was just doing a little bit of labouring for them. And it was in the evening, and they'd gone to bed, and I was sitting watching a film. And I couldn't tell you the title of the film or who was in it, and it wasn't really a very good film either. But it was something about the storyline that struck me. It was a pretty basic story about a woman whose husband had upped and gone and left her with the children. And it gave a pretty bleak view of men and a pretty bleak view of married life in particular. And I suddenly thought, hang on, is this what I'm letting myself in for? What if Rachel and I get married and in 10 years' time I just get up and go and leave her holding the baby, literally? Is that what it's going to be like? Is that how things really work? So it was a very simple trigger, But probably for the first time in my life, I actually started looking at things on a much deeper level. And I didn't like what I saw, because I started seeing all the rotten things in life in general. And worse still, I started seeing all the rotten things in me. And I saw how my every thought was actually to look after number one, rather than to have any concern for others. And then it went deeper than that. What happens when we die? That's it. Nothing. Nothing. So, you know, what was the point of it all? We're born, we live, we die, end of story. Now, you could say I was lucky to get to the age of 20 before confronting those sort of questions. But basically, I went from everything being fine with the world to pretty well absolute despair in the space of a few days. It was a really horrible experience. Still is, even, actually, you know, if you look back on it. So I can't claim it was a perfect parallel to Ecclesiastes, because at the time I was a total atheist, and the teacher certainly isn't that. But actually, I wrote down a lot of the things that were going through my mind at the time, and if you compared them to what we've been reading in these last few weeks, you would really struggle to tell some of it apart. So it went on this way for a little while, and then after about 6 weeks or so, I went out for a drink with three old classmates from school. I'd had a slight upturn after a few weeks when I realised that perhaps there could just be a God after all, and who was I to say there wasn't? But basically, I was still in a pretty bad place. So I went out with these three guys. Two of them happened to be Christians, but I don't think I'd gone out with them to talk about the meaning of life. I think it was just a question of catching up with them because I hadn't seen them for a little while. And I can't really remember how the conversation developed, but I do know we talked for a long while. And basically, at about midnight, one of them explained to me that we'd all been created to live in relationship with God. We'd all turned our backs on him and been separated from him, but Jesus paid the price for our sin on the cross, and because of this, we could be reconciled to him. And as I listened, I knew that every word he said was true, and it was quite extraordinary, because in that moment, absolutely everything changed. I'd had no church background, so the closest I ever got to a church was generally Christmas Eve down the pub, where some of my mates staggered over the road at about 11 o'clock to midnight mass, and I resolutely stayed in the pub because I thought it was hypocritical even to go into a church. So that was me. But God had brought me to a place where I saw for real all the fruitlessness of life under the sun. And as he revealed himself to me, everything changed. Because death was no longer the end. It was the beginning. So it's not we're born, we live, we die. It's we're born, we live, we die, then we live again. Only this time it's forever. So it was an extraordinary discovery. Life under the sun isn't the end of the story. You can know a better life around the corner. And there's an alternative to life under the sun, and that is life under the sun. One letter difference, but worlds apart. Life can be lived knowing God in relationship with him. And you know, it might not be highlighted in glorious technicolor in Ecclesiastes, but you can still see it if you look hard enough. Because you see, we've had a few prompts along the way. In verse 12, for example, remember your creator. And then we're told, verse 6, remember him again. And then in chapter 12, verse 7, we're told that the Spirit returns to God who gave it. So there is a clear acknowledgement of God's existence and our accountability before him. And yet, by and large, the major part of Ecclesiastes, the picture of God's pretty veiled. An assurance of what lies ahead is pretty well non-existent. So take chapter 11, verse 5. It's on the same page. You can just cast your eyes over to that. As you do not know the path of the wind or how the body is formed in a mother's womb, so you cannot understand the work of God, the maker of all things. So that's fairly typical of the sort of God's there pulling the strings, but don't expect to be able to understand in sort of language. And yet when we get to the last bit, to verses 9 to 14, there's just that little bit of a gear shift. Because verses 9 to 14 are the sort of editorial comment on Ecclesiastes. So the teacher stops speaking, and the commentator or the editor then comes in. So in verse 11, you've got this intriguing phrase where it says, the words of the wise are given by one shepherd. And it says, be wary of anything said in addition to these words. Then verse 12 goes on to talk about much study wearying the body. And finally, verses 13 and 14 say the meaning of life is actually quite simple. Fear God and do what he says. So it's as if he's saying, you can try as hard as you like to work God out by yourself. You can ask all the questions in the world, you can study as much as you like, but you're never, ever going to get there. The only way you can know the truth about him is by heeding the wise words given by the one shepherd. And those words tell you to honour God and do what he commands because you'll face judgment for how you live. So as if he's pointing out the futility of life lived only in the moment, to leave us yearning for something more, something which lasts. Ultimately, this life can never fully satisfy. And yet, you'll only be able to understand more when God stops playing his cards so close to his chest and shows you his hand. Which, of course, is where we come back full circle to Christmas. Because the real truth of Christmas, hidden beneath the tinsel and the turkey, is that God has shown us his hand. God has chosen to reveal himself in Jesus Christ. He is the Word become flesh. He is the one good shepherd. And it changes everything. It changed everything for the first disciples 2,000 years ago. It changed everything for me 30 years ago. And it changes everything for people today who he reveals himself to. And he hasn't just revealed himself as the good shepherd who came to live amongst us. He's also revealed himself as the good shepherd who came to die for us. The good shepherd who lays down his life for his sheep. So none of us fully do what Ecclesiastes demands. None of us fully live up to God's commands. But Jesus did. All of us should face condemnation on Judgment Day. But because Jesus has paid the ransom, we are free. If we come to Jesus and repent of our sins, he will forgive us, and we will experience eternity with him. If I had more time, I'd actually want to take you into Acts 17, there where you've got the Apostle Paul picking up a lot more on this theme of the unknown God becoming known as he preaches in Athens to the Athenians. If you've got time in between writing the Christmas cards and everything else, do have a look at it, because it's fascinating. And if you've got time to do that, have a little look at Romans 1 as well, because that's the other part of it, where we see how God reveals himself to some degree in creation, but not fully until Jesus has come. But for now, let me just leave you with this simple truth. The teacher points towards it, the whole of the book of Ecclesiastes does, the whole of the Old Testament does, and Christmas reminds us of it. God has revealed himself in Jesus Christ as the one shepherd who can be known. And when you discover that, it changes absolutely everything.